A global sigh of relief with the announcement of an 11th-hour ceasefire.
But it's certainly not a situation that seems to be sustainable.
The ceasefire with Iran, what it is and what comes next. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. The agreement came somewhat out of left field, brokered by Pakistan.
So if there was any Muslim country in the region that was not directly involved and had a good relationship with Trump, Pakistan was really able to sort of appeal to both sides.
We'll also hear reaction from inside Iran, plus the war's effect on Africa.
And pre-election polls in Hungary show Viktor Orban is behind, but
he's in a very good terms with Trump, with Netanyahu, with Putin, with Xi. And actually, that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to call it just yet.
All today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. The U.S. and Iran have taken a step back from the brink, but the ceasefire they and Israel have agreed to is fragile, more so by the minute. And details of the terms reached yesterday are murky and contested.
For starters, both sides are claiming victory. Iran TV announcing that, quote, the enemy has been dealt an undeniable, historic, and humiliating defeat against its criminal war. Meanwhile, U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth told reporters today that Iran had had enough.
Operation Epic Fury was a historic and overwhelming victory on the battlefield. A capital V military victory.
That's despite the fact that Iran's Supreme National Security Council issued a statement framing the deal as temporary and conditional. And after the brief reopening of the Strait of Hormuz with conditions, the strait is once again closed.
Israeli airstrikes on Lebanon have only escalated. Ali Vaez joined me today to put the ceasefire in perspective. He's Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group.
Already the ceasefire has been violated because the Iranians argue that this was supposed to be a region-wide ceasefire, including Lebanon, and Israel and the U.S. are rejecting that claim.
Right.
And it is quite possible that the Iranians would start firing at Israel again in retaliation for the attacks on Hezbollah, and so this ceasefire might fall apart very quickly.
Mm.
And even if it holds, it is very difficult to imagine that the fundamental issues that remain unresolved between Iran and the United States and are now exponentially more difficult to solve would be solved in the two-week period that is determined for the deadline that the president has put in place.
What are the terms of the ceasefire? You've already said there's some daylight between the two sides there.
Well, even that remains pretty vague at this point. The president, when he announced the ceasefire, made it clear that it was on the basis of a 10-point plan that Iran had sent to the U.S. via the Pakistani mediators. The 10-point plan that Iran has is a set of really maximalist positions, is the Iranian wish list. A few hours later, the president said that the 15-point plan that the U.S. had put on the table, which is the U.S. wish list seen by the Iranians as a set of maximalist demands, is what the U.S. is pursuing in these negotiations.
Mm. So President Trump has said both.
Exactly. It is unclear what would be the basis of negotiations. And again, on all the fundamental issues, they're still miles apart. And in addition to the future of Iran's nuclear program, Iran's missile program, Iran's support for proxies, issues that existed before this war, now there's a very complicated question of what happens to the Strait of Hormuz, this critical choke point in the aftermath of this war.
Are there signs so far that the strait is opening at all?
So the strait seems to have opened for a very short period of time, with Iran continuing to collect tolls for vessels that it would allow through the strait. And it was closed again when Israel started bombing Lebanon. The president, I think, has recognized that Iran would preserve its control over the strait. He hasn't even rejected the possibility that Iran would collect a transit fee, which the Iranians are framing as reparations for the war. But this has provided Iran with a weapon of mass disruption. It can really take the global economy hostage at will, and this makes Iran's neighbors, especially the Gulf states, very uncomfortable.
You have mentioned Lebanon already. Israel has been pummeling southern Lebanon, even striking central Beirut. Israel says the Iran ceasefire does not apply there. Why is Lebanon not part of this deal, at least from Israel's perspective?
Well, from Israel's perspective, Hezbollah remains a threat, and it has already demonstrated through attacks that it has conducted against Israel that it retains significant firepower. And it was acting in concert with Iran this time around. They were targeting the same sites at the same time, which made it so much more difficult for Israeli air defense system to shoot them down. The dilemma for the Iranians is that they are afraid that if the war against Hezbollah continues, Israel would basically degrade Hezbollah, destroy its capabilities in the next 2 weeks, only to then turn its attention back at Iran again. Mm. And at that point, Iran would be in a weaker position to defend itself because it's alone. And because Iran has not gone to Hezbollah's defense, it would be discredited in the eyes of some of its other regional allies like the Houthis in Yemen, who were a big part of Iran's strategic calculus in terms of next steps in the escalation ladder. If the U.S. were to put boots on the ground or to target Iranian infrastructure, the goal was for the Iranians to then push the Houthis to close Bab al-Mandab, the second critical choke point which connects the Red Sea to Indian Ocean and through which two-thirds of Saudi oil was passing through. And that would push the price of oil above $200 a barrel.
Wow.
So this is all part of Iran's strategic calculus that if the ceasefire is not regional, then it basically is not a ceasefire at all.
So very strong incentive there for Iran to keep fighting.
Yes, exactly. And it basically creates a dilemma for President Trump as well. Does he allow Netanyahu's plan to degrade Hezbollah, to drag the U.S. back into a conflict with Iran and continued blockage of the Strait of Hormuz, which disrupts energy markets, food markets? Or does he lean on Netanyahu to stop the war in Lebanon as well? That will be the choice for the president in the coming hours.
Interesting. I do want to get a little bit more into the mechanics of this ceasefire deal. Reports suggest that Iran's supreme leader, Mujtaba Khamenei, has been communicating with runners who were passing notes in the past couple of days. That's despite an ongoing risk of assassination for him. What can you tell us about how exactly this deal was actually hammered out?
There are more questions than answers about whether the new supreme leader is alive or is incapacitated or not. If he is, his approval would have been essential. And of course, because of security concerns, he's passing messages through couriers rather than in any digital form.
Do you think that the claims that he might be dead are credible?
So far, there hasn't been any audio or video that indicates he's alive. That might be for security reasons, but
right,
it also might be that he's grievously injured.
Pakistan has invited both sides to talks, I believe, on Friday. Now the next steps are very much uncertain, but both sides do say they are ready for further negotiations. Which side is in a stronger position heading into those negotiations?
Look, I think this war had turned into a lose-lose dynamic for both sides. Yes, Iran survived, and that is victory from their perspective, but the war came at a very heavy cost for them. And towards the end, they were losing infrastructure they would not be able to replace anytime soon. And at the same time, you know, the United States went into this with a set of objectives, including regime change or destroying Iran's capacity to fire drones and missiles, which it did not achieve. Nevertheless, it was able to significantly degrade Iran's military capabilities and also eliminate some of Iran's key political and military leaders. But it had really reached, the war had reached a stage that neither side was able to deliver a decisive blow to the other. And the next steps in the escalation ladder would have resulted in a situation that might have spiraled out of control. And so I think neither side really has the upper hand. Mm. And this is one of the reasons that the negotiations would be difficult.
Ali Vaez is Iran Project Director at the International Crisis Group. This is, of course, a changing story, and we will keep following it.
Even with the ceasefire, there are reports of new attacks on Tehran. Earlier today, though, people in Iran's capital were out and about, trying to get back to a sense of normalcy. The World's Shirin Jafari was in touch with people on the ground and joins me now with more. Shirin, it has been 40 days since the start of this war. A lot has happened. What are you hearing today?
Marco, I've kept in touch with one man called Mehdi. He has stayed in Tehran for most of this war, and he sends me regular updates about what he's feeling and the mood in the city and what's going on. I messaged him yesterday to hear what he thinks of President Trump's comment that he's going to destroy Iran's civilization if the government doesn't agree to open up the Strait of Hormuz. And Mehdi wrote back. He said, you know, I'm so exhausted with this war. I don't even know who to believe or what to believe anymore. But then after the ceasefire was announced, I did hear from him. The announcement came in the early hours of the morning in Tehran. He says he stayed up all night to hear the announcement. He says it feels as if someone has been choking you, and then they release their hands for a few minutes, and then they go back to choking you. Basically saying that he doesn't know if the ceasefire is going to hold up and whether we are going to hear bombings again, just like we did today.
Yeah, right. Well, with this seeming break that people in Iran are getting, has normal life resumed for some people?
Mehdi said people started coming out today. They tried to catch up with things that they had put on pause. And he saw even some people jogging for the first time in and around Tehran. He sent me this sound from a cafe. He said it was really nice to see something that resembles normal life again.
Yeah, I mean, just the sound of people talking and milling about. I can see the pots of coffee and tea and felt the normalcy. On the flip side, though, we have seen a lot of damage and destruction in Tehran specifically. What kind of help do those who lost their homes, what kind of help are they getting?
As far as we know, not much. I haven't heard of any assistance from the government. What I'm hearing is that many of these people are staying with friends or relatives. And what Mehdi in Tehran was telling me is that this ceasefire feels like a much-needed respite from the nonstop airstrikes that we have seen in Tehran. These bombings usually happen at night when people are trying to sleep, and this has really impacted their sleep and how they are feeling, their mood and their daily life.
So from analysis, we're hearing that it's not really a regime change as the White House has been trumpeting, kind of like an Islamic Republic 2.0. So how are Iranians feeling about that?
It's impossible to capture what roughly 90 million people in Iran are feeling about this war. It's also hard to connect with people inside Iran because the government has shut down the internet. Some people are able to get online using very expensive VPNs. So we don't really hear as much from those who can't afford these expensive technologies. But in general, people are polarized. A good portion of the population supported foreign intervention with the hope that it will bring down the 40-year-old oppressive regime in Tehran. That hasn't happened. Despite what President Trump says, that this is a change in leadership, it's really a continuation of the previous system, maybe even more hardline and aggressive now, given that it has been bloodied and bruised from this war.
It is unclear if the ceasefire is going to hold up. If it does, though, Shirin, and if Trump and the current Iranian government agree to a permanent deal, where does that leave the anti-government protests?
What is clear from what happened in January, the protests, is that, again, a lot of people want fundamental changes to the system. They want these leaders gone. However, there's also a sense of weariness about the war. Besides the human loss, people have been out of work for weeks on end. Schools have been out. The country has basically come to a standstill. For some people, this has raised nationalistic sentiments. We saw yesterday, for example, as President Trump threatened to destroy Iran's civilization, people spoke up against it. And when the government asked people to physically go to bridges and power plans to form human chains, some did. So again, there are a lot of mixed feelings about this moment among Iranians. This is what Mehdi told me. He says a lot of people are confused. They really don't know what to think. On the one hand, we want these people gone. On the other, this war has left us with nothing but death and destruction.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you very much for this update, as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
A look at Pakistan as mediator is ahead. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. We have been looking at how the oil shock caused by the war in Iran is impacting different regions. In Africa, that impact is concentrated in the eastern part of the continent, according to Amaka Anku with the Eurasia Group. She told me earlier that's partly due to how much of the region's oil used to travel through the Strait of Hormuz.
A lot of it is geography, but also some politics, right? So Kenya and Ethiopia, for example, have historically been aligned with Israel and the UAE, in part because of the proximity, but there's also been other kind of political alliances.
So in those places, maybe Kenya, for example, what does this look like for regular people? How is the oil crisis right now affecting daily life there?
There was some panic buying in South Africa, in Kenya, even in Zambia. We've seen prices go up, especially diesel in South Africa, by a lot. I think in a place like Kenya, they have elections next year. So this has a political angle. The government is really trying not to allow prices to get too high. So they haven't raised prices, but that is going to create fiscal problems down the line because they're going to have to cover that shortfall.
So, of course, prices are not just going up for diesel, for gas at the pump. Those are also things that raise prices for everything from food to fertilizer. Exactly. What is that looking like on the ground in impacted countries?
Yes. So I think the longer this goes on, my assumption is that prices will be high. They'll stay high for the rest of the year. And so that's something that we are watching, because it's also the fact that a lot of transportation is powered by diesel. And that will mean that you're going to see price increases across the board. So in general, the obvious impact for the whole region is going to be higher inflation. I will say, though, that if you look at, you know, the last time we saw a shock like this, which was after the Ukraine war in February 2022, all of these countries are actually better placed today than they were. Hmm. Inflation is lower. In part because since Trump too, commodity prices have been so high that a lot of places have much better FX buffers than they did in 2022, which meant that their currencies were stronger because they had, you know, more FX reserves. They were
FX,
better able to support
meaning foreign exchange.
FX, foreign exchange, yes, exactly. And so in general, across the board, inflation is lower today than it was in January 2022, which does give you a little bit more room for inflation to go higher before it starts to cause unrest.
So commodity prices are higher, and thus countries are keeping more foreign exchange in reserve. And so that's helping protect against inflation. Did I get that? Did I understand that right?
Yeah. So let me give you an example. Ghana, obviously, you've seen record gold prices over the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Ghana just came out of a restructuring. They had inflation at 14% January 2022 before the Ukraine war. Now it's at 3%, right? And they at record, because they've been exporting so much gold, they have record foreign exchange levels because they're getting almost 70% of their export earnings from gold right now, just from the price increases.
Wow.
Right? And so that has helped their currency strengthen, which has dropped prices across the board because in terms of imported inputs were much cheaper. So it just gives them a little bit more room for prices to still go up. And people still feel that they're better off than they were.
Interesting.
5 years ago.
Are there government level responses to either these high gas prices or the expected trickle down effects that we are seeing already?
So, for example, in Kenya, the government-level response is basically a political decision not to allow prices to go up. In a place like Senegal, where they already had subsidies on gas prices, right, the government-level response is to, again, not allow prices to go up. So those are the kinds of responses we're seeing. We're not seeing anything like kind of broader stimulus package or anything. And we don't expect that in Africa. That's one of the things that is often the case, that African countries usually can't afford a big stimulus package, but it's still early on anyway. I think most of the government response we're going to see is going to come in terms of how they respond to rising prices for gas, for pump gas, right? Do they let it rise? Or do they try to basically run a larger subsidy?
Mm, interesting. Which would then mean, you know, more pressure
down
on their exactly. budgets.
And maybe down the line, more debt distress.
Several African countries, Nigeria and Angola are a couple of examples, are themselves oil producers and exporters. Are they right now able to take advantage of these higher prices and scarcity of supply?
Not right now. So that's a very good question, because a lot of these countries sell crude on long-term contracts. We do expect that oil prices will stay high for the rest of the year. So a lot of these countries started with a budget benchmark of $65 for oil prices. And I think we're going to end up with prices above $80 for the rest of the year, regardless of when the conflict ends. And so even though there's limited ability to benefit immediately, they will probably benefit by the time you average out, you know, prices over the course of the year. So by the time they've delivered the cargoes that they have already contracted to over the next couple of months, then they might be able to benefit in the second half of the year.
When they write up new contracts with new prices, you mean?
Exactly.
Got it.
Exactly. And then also I would add that for countries like Nigeria and Angola, their oil and gas sector will look more attractive after this longer term. There's already been, for a place like Nigeria, several international oil companies that were considering final investment decisions. There's been some investment pledges that were made to drill new wells. I would bet that after this huge oil supply shock, those investments look more attractive as a way of diversifying away from Gulf oil production.
Interesting. So some long-term impacts there.
Yes.
We have talked about some of the long-term potential benefits to oil-producing countries like Nigeria and Angola. I'm wondering about long-term negative impacts of higher oil prices. Are there ways that different countries are preparing for that reality, you know, to be a long-term change?
Honestly, I think that it's more that there are two ways to think about the long-term negatives from higher oil prices. One is for the countries that run subsidies, which is not all of them, right? If you are running a subsidy, that subsidy bill is going to get bigger and it's going to make you more vulnerable to debt distress in the long term, right? Just because now you're borrowing more, potentially at higher prices to cover this cost. You're not investing, you're not making investments in productivity and competitiveness. So that could be a long-term cost. But I think most of the longer-term costs are really going to fall on businesses and the private sector, because a lot of central banks were in an easing cycle. They were dropping interest rates, and now they're going to have to raise interest rates or hold. And that's going to mean higher borrowing costs for businesses, which, like, you know, we've said, means higher prices for inflations, but which also means higher income for businesses, because mm-hmm. now people have less money to spend on things like telecom or whatever else. So I think a lot of the longer term costs will be squeezing margins on businesses, which will then may have some impact in terms of revenues that governments can collect. So it's a lot of it is the fiscal impact and then the business growth impact long term.
Amaka Anku of Eurasia Group spoke to us from Washington. This is The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The fragile ceasefire announced by the U.S. and Iran last night was brokered by a country long seen by the U.S. and others in the West as a pariah state, Pakistan. The mistrust came from Pakistan's dealings with the Taliban and al-Qaeda after 9/11 and during the war in Afghanistan. Much has changed, though. Case in point, Pakistan brokered this peace deal while fighting the Taliban. Akhil Shah has been following these changes. He's a political scientist at McDaniel College.
So Pakistan has long fashioned itself as sort of a unique country that's a Muslim majority country, the only one that has a nuclear bomb. And its primary concern is India. And it, so it's always tried to sort of connect itself to the broader Muslim community to overcome the power deficit it has with India. And so, you know, going back to 1971, Pakistan brokered talks between the U.S. and China. Just before the U.S. withdrew from Afghanistan, Pakistan also helped facilitate U.S.-Taliban talks, because at the time, the Taliban was Pakistan's ally. And more recently, I think it has to do with a couple of reasons. One, you know, the economic impact on Pakistan is quite considerable. Rise in fuel prices, the economy is already in a crisis. So there's that economic driver. But more than that, because Pakistan is in a position, it has a sort of direct line. The Pakistani military chief, who Trump is very fond of and calls my favorite field marshal, has a direct line and access to President Trump that was facilitated by Pakistan's recognition that Donald Trump was the one who stopped a potential nuclear war between India and Pakistan in May 2025. And then Pakistan officially and publicly nominated Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. In terms of the Iran angle, in addition to the economy, it's also geography. Pakistan shares a long border with Iran. 15 to 20% of Pakistan's population is Shia, which is the dominant majority religion in Iran. And so Pakistan has sort of tried to position itself as the strategic power who can sort of reach out of region and play an extra regional part. And sort of Pakistan has always tried to break out of South Asia and to try to equalize strategically with India. And this has been one of the ways in which it has achieved that.
So, yeah, lots of reasons. Before this mediation role, Pakistan had been seen as something of a pariah state by Western countries like the U.S., going back to its role in the so-called war on terror, remembering allegations of Pakistan playing this double game, supporting the Taliban, Pervez Musharraf hearing from President George W. Bush after 9/11. If you don't want to be bombed back to the Stone Age, you must be on our side and stop dealing with al-Qaeda. So help us understand this period in relations leading up to this point.
The United States seems to be in the habit of bombing countries to the Stone Age. Pakistan was a pariah state right up to the end of the Biden administration. Once the United States left Afghanistan, there was really no strategic interest in Washington for engaging with Pakistan. And then Pakistan was able to see that the importance of building personal ties to Donald Trump. So Pakistan seemed to suggest that it was interested in a partnership with World Financial Liberty, which is the Trump family-affiliated crypto exchange. Pakistan also tried to pitch itself as an alternative for rare earth minerals for the U.S. The chief of army staff literally brought a briefcase full of critical minerals to the White House and was photographed showing it to Trump. So that deep connection to Trump and the fact that Trump felt really slighted by India, because India completely denied any role for the Trump administration in defusing the war between India and Pakistan in May 2025. Whereas Pakistan basically, as Trump likes to sort of repeat over and over, that the Pakistanis told me that I saved millions of lives. Sort of this personal legacy that Trump believes he should have in being a great leader. So Pakistan has really cleverly tapped into that and has built a very good, productive relationship with the Trump administration.
I was going to say, Akhil, it sounds like Pakistan understood early on how to deal with President Trump.
Absolutely, yeah. Trump had a one-on-one lunch with the Pakistani Army Chief of Staff, General Asim Munir. Now, that's unprecedented because Asim Munir was not a head of state. And so Trump invited Munir to a sort of one-on-one lunch with him. And one of the things that came out of that lunch was that Trump basically said that Pakistan is close to Iran, it knows a lot about Iran, and that Pakistan might play a critical role in the U.S.-Iran relationship. So that was the first indication that Pakistan was pitching itself as the regional power that the Trump administration could rely on.
Yes, it would seem that there's been a dividend for Trump by getting close with these officials in Pakistan. Now, as for Iran, mediating countries have to have a relationship with both sides in a war.
Yeah.
What about Pakistan's relationship with Iran here? What do we know?
So Pakistan's relationship has been a little complicated because there is an Baloch ethnic minority insurgency in the region of Iran that borders Pakistan. And so there was a crisis or tensions between Iran and Pakistan. There was a missile attack from Iran. Pakistan retaliated. But beyond that, I think Pakistan has had a close relationship with Iran, in part because of the border. Secondly, Pakistan has a 20% population that's Shiite. And so if there was any Muslim country in the region that was not directly involved in the conflict with Iran and had a good relationship with Trump, Pakistan was really able to sort of appeal to both sides as the bridge builder, as it were.
So I'm curious, Akhil, about the fact you brought up earlier about Pakistan being a nuclear armed power. What difference does that make specifically when we're talking about this war, given Iran's ambitions around a nuclear weapon?
So first of all, it gives you that international prestige of being in this exclusive club, right? It signifies this, even though Pakistan is a much smaller country than, let's say, India, it's militarily and economically weaker. But it has sort of been able to parry India with this nuclear deterrent. The other angle is that Pakistan actually signed a major defense pact with Saudi Arabia, which basically was designed to protect Saudi Arabia in case of a conflict, primarily with Israel. So a senior Saudi minister recently made a claim that if Israel were to attack Saudi Arabia, or there was a major war, Pakistan would actually extend its nuclear umbrella to Saudi Arabia. So Pakistan would have been a very awkward situation if it had to come to Saudi Arabia's rescue in a potential wider war with Iran. So that's one of the reasons why the nuclear capability gives Pakistan the strategic leverage over almost the entire Middle East in that sense.
It sounds like the relationship between the U.S. government and Pakistan's leadership has changed. But at the start of the war last month, there were massive protests in Islamabad.
Yes.
The perimeter of the U.S. embassy was breached. Protesters were killed. What tensions have this war created in Pakistan?
So obviously it was seen as another war of aggression on a fellow neighboring Muslim country. And that is part of the reason why the Pakistani military found itself in an awkward position, because it was seen very closely tied to Trump. On the other hand, there is domestic pressure on Pakistani establishment to take sides with Iran. So by positioning itself as a neutral party that wants to mediate between the U.S. and Iran, it was also able to deflect that pressure and sort of move away from this domestic image as very close to Trump or very pro-American.
Do you think this gives Pakistan leverage over the U.S. going forward?
So Pakistan does need economic support in terms of loans from the IMF, which the United States has significant control or influence over. Pakistan would also like to get more military hardware from the U.S., although it currently relies primarily on China, because the United States primarily stopped supplying the Pakistani military with hardware. So Pakistan would be looking at that. Plus, Pakistan has been able to lure American investment or Trump's interest and investment in critical minerals like copper. So there's been at least initially, a U.S. firm has invested $500 million in, exploring copper and gold reserves in Pakistan.
So last question, Akhil, in your opinion, where do the liabilities lie by yoking ceasefire enforcement and, one would hope, peace by having Pakistan lead these negotiations?
I don't really see any significant drawback, given that President Trump has entered a war for which there was no real endgame, and the United States was bogged down in that sense, especially with Iran's capacity to block the Strait of Hormuz and, you know, affect the global economy, global energy. So that crisis, really, whether or not there's a liability, the Trump administration really needed a way out. And I think Pakistan came handy in giving Trump that off-ramp. Otherwise, the goals of the war kept changing. There was really no way out short of a ground invasion. So in a sense, I think for Trump, this is really the win he desperately needed.
That was Akhil Shah speaking with us from New York. He's the author of The Army and Democracy, Military Politics in Pakistan.
The impact that extreme heat has on the body is pretty well understood, but it also has an impact on our mental health. In Bangladesh, where the mercury hits 90 for months on end, that is felt acutely. One group is measuring what that means for the prevalence of common mental health disorders in one of the country's biggest informal settlements. I visited there earlier this year. Poor urban neighborhoods in Bangladesh look like they are custom designed to amplify heat. Here in Tungi, just outside the capital of Dhaka, small metal houses are crowded together along narrow alleyways. No breeze and no shade in sight. Amina Begum tells me through an interpreter that the two-room house she shares with her son's family gets punishingly hot in the summer.
As we are so low-class family, we don't have an AC and we don't have any cold place.
Do you have running water at your house?
She doesn't, she tells me. She collects water from a neighbor's house, then boils it to drink.
It's difficult to take enough water and hydrate myself.
Begum is wearing a long, loose dress and a headscarf, but in the heat of summer, she says she strips down to just her slip. Her family gets annoyed, but she tells them to stop harassing her, she says, because she is dying in the heat. About half of Bangladesh's urban population lives in informal settlements where there are few options to stay cool. Even when I visit in February, sweat trickles down the back of my neck.
It's the middle of winter and there's a bruise today and I'm still hot.
Yes. Nurul Islam Biplop works for a nonprofit called the Sajida Foundation.
So it becomes unbearably hot during summer.
He and his team are studying the link between that heat and mental health here, where neighborhoods are clustered around the garment factories that we're walking by.
So this is the factory, so most of people, they work here.
We pop into a quieter alley to talk.
As you can see, this is highly packed neighborhood. There's no spaces in between and no shade.
Last year, his team placed temperature sensors inside hundreds of these houses.
Ambient temperature would be more than 40, but inside...
It's over 100 Fahrenheit.
100, yes. And the indoor temperature sometimes reach more than 50, like 125.
Wow.
Yes.
His team then gave mental health questionnaires to people living in those homes, more than 450 women.
We have found that extreme heat has a direct impact on person's mental health, and it also has direct impact on domestic violence.
On extremely hot days indoors, the risk of anxiety went up 28%. The risk of domestic violence increased during hotter months by about 9%. Research conducted around the world has linked heat waves with increased rates of suicide, stress, irritability, and anxiety, as well as a higher risk of hospitalization for mental and behavioral disorders. Sharmeen Akhtar, a young mother who lives here, has struggled with depression. She has faint scars on one of her wrists, exposed under the sleeve of her baby pink salwar kameez. She tells me she cut herself during a rough patch with her husband. While we're sitting, talking under a ceiling fan, she tells me that in the heat, everything feels more tense. When it's too hot, the human temper is high and we don't feel like working, she says. Under our tin roofs, it's always hotter. And cooking inside over a stove using firewood, she says, that makes it even hotter, which makes me feel even worse. In this poor neighborhood, money is a big stressor. But when it's hot, surveys that Biplop and his team conducted shows the heat layers on even more stress.
Relationship between husband and wife and with other family members become strained because people are irritated. Simple conversation turn into fight very quickly. And the challenge is there is no respite from it.
Air conditioning is not an option. Electricity is expensive, so even fans are used sparingly.
You understand that it's affecting you both physically and mentally, but there is nothing you can do. So they become trapped.
In Bangladesh, according to the World Bank, it will feel hotter than 95 degrees for more than 4 months a year if greenhouse gas emissions keep climbing quickly. That is twice as long as today. Biplop says reducing the heat here would take huge systemic change that's out of reach for just one organization. So what it's doing to try to help is offer mental health services, screening, one-on-one counseling, and group sessions. In a small rented building in the middle of the community, there are about a dozen women sitting on the floor, on floor mats, cross-legged, in a wellness session. The facilitator right now has two puppets that they're using to illustrate someone who is mentally well and someone who's having some troubles. Shafin Fatma is running the session.
We are trying to make them aware about mental health issues, that you shouldn't keep it silently. You should speak up.
Charmaine Akhtar, the young mom with the scars on her wrist, tells me she didn't know what mental health was before coming here. Now she's learned some coping strategies. A couple of miles away, Amina Begum tells me she feels tired and restless in the heat. She sweats, her heart races, she has trouble relaxing. But she hasn't heard of these mental health sessions. She can barely get to the doctor, who prescribes her heart medication she cannot afford. What she does do is pray. She prays to Allah to make winter last all 12 months of the year, she says, because she just can't tolerate the heat.
So, Carolyn, of course, winter is not going to last all 12 months of the year. In fact, it's already getting hot here now. Are there any other strategies in Bangladesh or the region to make things better?
Of course, Marco. Around the world, there are efforts to plant trees in urban spaces to provide shade and replace asphalt and concrete with green space to cool things down. There are architectural styles and building materials that have been used for millennia to lower indoor temperatures, increase airflow. Lots of cities have cooling centers, public spaces where the AC is pumping so people can get a bit of respite. And of course, on a much larger scale, there is this global effort to slow climate change so that the heat does not get so much worse. But right now, in poor neighborhoods, in poor countries, it's really a development issue. Houses are made of metal because metal is cheaper than other building materials. They're built close together because land is scarce and expensive. There's often no running water to help people stay hydrated. So, you know, until some of those larger development issues are addressed in places like urban slums or informal settlements in Bangladesh, these kind of fixes that I was reporting on around the edges seem to be the most realistic.
Carolyn, thank you very much for your reporting.
Thank you, Marco.
Returning briefly to the day's top story, we have heard today that not only have Israeli strikes on Lebanon continued through the ceasefire, they've actually been more intense today than at any other point so far in this war. Israel says Lebanon is excluded from the truce, but as Ali Vaez of International Crisis Group explained earlier, the continued strikes pose a problem for Iran.
They're afraid that if the war against Hezbollah continues, Israel would basically degrade Hezbollah, destroy its capabilities in the next 2 weeks, only to then turn its attention back at Iran again. At that point, Iran would be in a weaker position.
Tomorrow, we go deep on what's happening in Lebanon. Be sure and tune in for that.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The U.S. president and NATO are not exactly on the best of terms, but the organization's chairman, Mark Rutte, is in Washington trying to warm up that chilly relationship. One European friendship that's going just fine with the Trump administration is with Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban. U.S. Vice President J.D. Vance is in Budapest this week, hoping to keep Orban in power. As The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, polls suggest Europe's longest-serving leader could be brought down by a popular opponent.
Hello, hello. Hello, hello.
Peter Mayor has been touring Hungary relentlessly for well over a year now. In the small southern city of Kiskunhalas, a Viktor Orban stronghold, the slim 45-year-old strolled through a crowd of excited supporters a few days ago, shaking hands and waving a huge Hungarian flag. On the stage, he lambasted the current prime minister. When did Orban last talk about healthcare, about education, the cost of living crisis, about people's real problems, he said. Later, Mayor asked why J.D. Vance was coming to Hungary just a few days before the election. No foreign country should interfere in Hungarian elections. This is our country, he said. At a press conference yesterday, Vance said it was the EU that was doing all the interfering.
What has happened in the midst of this election campaign is one of the worst examples of foreign election interference that I've ever seen or ever even read about. The bureaucrats in Brussels have tried to destroy the economy of Hungary.
A few hours later, Vance put President Trump on speakerphone at a rally packed with Orban supporters. And then he said,
"It's obviously a tough act to follow, but I'm going to do my best because we have got to get
Viktor Orban re-elected as Prime Minister of Hungary, don't we?
Every independent poll, though, has Viktor Orban trailing Peter Mayor, although some political analysts say you can't write Orban off just yet.
He's in a very good terms with Trump, with Netanyahu, with Putin, with Xi. And actually, that's why I'm a little bit hesitant to call it just yet.
Tibor Dejoufi is a social sciences professor at ELTE University in Budapest. Up to 2 years ago, Peter Mayor was virtually unknown outside of political circles in Hungary. Formerly a member of Orbán's Fidesz party, he was married to its then justice minister. But in early 2024, he publicly accused his former colleagues of corruption and cronyism and resigned from the party. Dejoufi says Mayor's charisma and his clever use of social media have won him voters of all stripes. But most of all, he says, Mayor gave voters, exhausted with 16 years of Orban rule, a sense of hope. Christian Martin in Budapest is one of those hopeful voters.
What I see is that this is a historical point of turning the country back to a democracy or just losing all hope and becoming a Belarus-type dictatorship.
Martin, a writer, says he doesn't necessarily agree with the opposition leader's centre-right views. Martin wrote a book about growing up mixed race and gay in Hungary a couple of years ago. His book is banned in any bookstore located within 200 metres of a church or a school. He knows Peter Mayor rarely talks about LGBTQ issues, he says, but that's because it may alienate some more conservative voters, he says.
I can accept that this is not that time. I know it sounds bad, but I don't know, the stakes are just much higher.
Helga, who works in the arts in Budapest, says she doesn't see Mayor as the ideal candidate either, but he's the only realistic alternative, she says.
I see many problems with him, but I have to say his progress, personal, political progress, community forming progress is unprecedented.
Orban's government has driven many people out of this country, she says.
I have a daughter who actually studied this abroad because the most important areas like education, the health system, the social system is all really bad in Hungary.
Still, Helga says, there are members of her own wider family circle who are planning to vote for Orban. And on the streets of Budapest last month, thousands gathered to support him. Some held up signs that read, "No to war." Orban has made the war in Ukraine a central issue in his campaign. We don't want to get involved in their war, voter Josef Orsos tells AP. It's about our children and our grandchildren here. We want peace here in Hungary, he says. Peter Mayor has taken a cautious approach to Ukraine and, like Orban, opposes fast-tracking Ukraine's accession to the EU. Hungarian analyst Tibor Dejoufi says the results of Sunday's election may be known by later that night.
Sunday at 11, many Hungarians feel dancing and many Hungarians will be totally horrified. It depends which part of the political spectrum will dancing and which part will be horrified.
And whoever wins, he says, the ripple effect will be felt far outside of Hungary. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
We leave you today in Tehran. An Iranian musician I know in Los Angeles, Azam Ali, recently made me aware of the Honiak Music Academy in Tehran. A friend of hers, musician and teacher, Hamid Reza Afrideh, and his wife, spent years fundraising and recruiting instructors and students. But in an instant last month, a missile destroyed everything. Gone were the instruments as well as the dreams of young artists. Recently, my friend posted a video made by Afrideh. We see him seated in the ruins of the music school, holding an instrument known as the kamanche. It's about the size of a violin, also with a bow, but played on your lap. Afrideh looks into the camera and speaks.
Salam, Hamid Reza Afrideh hastam. Mudiriyat amuzishgahi ke alan dige nabood shode.
I am Hamid Reza Afrideh at the music academy that has been destroyed, he says. I wanted the last sound from the school not to be the sound of missiles and war.
Thank you.
As he nears the end of his performance, you can hear the concussions of bombs in the background. He doesn't flinch. He just looks to the sky and finds his last note.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
PRX. From PRX.